creating cultural awareness and understanding. This is Culture Click. Culture Click is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University.
On this episode of Culture Click, we visit with a local vineyard that has been so successful, it is currently adding an addition to the building. As we visit with the owners, you will hear the sounds of progress and expansion as the two fill us in on how their journey began, the process of creating wine, and plans for the future. I'm Terry Tenseth, and you're listening to Culture Click. I'm at Garvin Heights Vineyards with Marvin and Linda Seppinen, who together own and operate this business, right?
Right.
What made you say, I want to go ahead and start a vineyard?
We bought this land 30 years ago, and we started planting grapes about 25 years ago. And we gradually increased the number of grapes that we had, and we finally got up. We were making wine for our own use, and finally got to the point where we couldn't legally make any more wine. So we either had to find a place to sell our grapes or start our own winery. And we made the choice to start the winery. So basically that was 8 years ago that we got our federal license and started putting up this building and made our first commercial wine.
What is the legal amount you can make before having to make that decision?
200 gallons.
Okay. So yeah, that's quite a bit.
And that's per family use.
Per year.
Okay. Household, not individual.
Okay.
If there's multiple individuals.
So what kind of big changes did you have to make to jump from your 200 gallon status to the business 8 years ago?
Well, pretty much when we started, we were making wine in the small carboys, the 5 gallon carboys and so on. So initially we weren't much bigger than that. But now we're making wine in tanks as much as 1,500 liters each. And typically 600 liters is what we make our batches of wine at. So it's just bigger volumes and so on, which in a sense is easier because if you have a big batch of wine, you just hook up the hoses and pump it from one place to another. You don't have to lift up carboys and do that manual labor.
It's luxury to have this much better equipment.
A lot of people might not know what goes into winemaking, so could you explain the process a little bit?
Yeah, basically you start with the grapes. We picked some grapes last Saturday. On Sunday we pressed them out and we got the juice. That juice has now been cooled and we're kind of separating out some of the solids and letting some enzymes work on it to break down the grape solids. Later on tomorrow I will take that juice, get rid of some of the solids, and then mix up yeast to add to it. And the yeast with some starter material will then start the fermentation. And after about a week, it will be converted all to alcohol. And then it's a matter of clarifying the wine, which in that case, that wine will probably bottle next spring. It'll take that much time for it to be fully clarified and filtered and ready to be bottled.
That's a white wine.
So there's a different process for...
For the reds. There's different process for the reds, for the rosés,
okay,
and for the ports.
Can you go into a little bit of that?
Well, for the red wine, instead of pressing out the grapes and getting the juice, we'll just crush the grapes and put them into a tank and add the yeast to that must, they call it, which is the skins and the seeds and the grapes themselves. And so as it's fermenting, it will be picking up flavor from the skins and the seeds and color. And then after 2 weeks or so when it's all done fermenting, then we'll squeeze out the skins and remove them, and so you get the pure wine. So that's really the difference between a red and a white wine is that processing. And then in the case of a rosé, we take a red grape, make the juice, and then ferment it, and it's much lighter in color because of the we've gotten rid of the skins and the seeds.
You get to practice some creativity, though, with flavors, right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes.
There's a lot of creativity in that we can probably select from about 50 different kinds of yeasts, and each yeast will have different characteristics in terms of making the wine floral or flower-like or bringing out other flavors within the wine. And so these yeasts have been developed over hundreds of years in parts of the world, and now they're all cultured and marketed. And so we get a large catalog, and then we select which yeast typically work good with the grapes we have here in Minnesota and Wisconsin.
And part of decision-making and looking at what kind of a final product you're going to have will be back even in the vineyard, figuring out, well, what's the chemistry of the grape that we desire? You know, what's the sugar level? What's the acid level? And sometimes, oh, well.
You're expanding, hence you're building onto the building, and we're hearing an air compressor for those people at home who are hearing it. So you said that it depends on the chemical makeup of the grape.
Right, because how ripe they are, how much sugar is there, and each grape variety will ripen and develop in different ways. And so then we are looking at what we want to do with that final product and back it up into the vineyard. You always got to have good grapes, period.
What kind of grapes are you using since we're here in Minnesota?
Well, we have the grapes that will survive our winters. So we have four grapes that the University of Minnesota developed. We have a few that other independent grape breeders have developed. So in total, we have 16 different varieties of grapes. Now, some of them, we only have a few vines, so obviously they get mixed together. But of the primary five or six, we have sufficient grapes in order to make a reasonable-sized batch of wine. Ideally, a large grower should have perhaps an acre of grapes, and that's enough to make maybe 500 gallons of wine. And that's what most wineries are interested in, maybe doing 500-gallon batches. We don't have quite that much of any one because we only have about 4 acres of grapes spread over 16 varieties. And that's kind of the way we started as a hobbyist and moved into it. We don't have the large blocks of grapes, which would be optimal at this point. But it does give us a chance to experiment with new grapes.
Can you give us some of the names of the grapes?
Oh, certainly. Probably one of the oldest that's been around is Frontenac. And then there's Frontenac Gris, La Crescent, and Marquette. And all four of those were developed by the University of Minnesota. And then some of the independent breeders' varieties, St. Croix, St. Pepin, La Crosse, Edelweiss, Brianna. Well, we just planted some Petite Pearl. That should be an interesting one. We don't have any mature enough to have it in the bottle right now.
That's interesting, developed by the state of Minnesota, because I think the Honeycrisp apple was also developed.
And Sweet Tangle.
Oh, yeah. Lots of things that have come out of Minnesota for the better of everybody's taste buds. What else do you use for flavoring? Like if you wanted to make something taste a specific way, is it just the yeast in the grapes, or is it sometimes infused with other things?
For the most part, all of ours are just the grape. We do blend several different kinds of grapes together, and we do have one flavored wine, and that's a red wine that's flavored with peach and chocolate flavoring. And it's an extra step with the federal government in order to get such a thing approved. And then we do have one other wine that's a blend of cranberry wine and grape wine. And again, there's an extra step with the federal government when you blend grape with a non-grape product. If you make straight cranberry, straight raspberry, which we also do, that's a straightforward thing. But when you blend the two, then it becomes a formula wine in the light of the federal government.
So there's extra paperwork? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. It has to be approved in advance. And in the case of the flavorings, they have to be FDA-approved flavors. So you have to have the documentation from the flavoring company. And they make flavorings for standard food products, so it's something they do for all of their customers, so it's not specifically for wine business.
Did you ever envision that this was going to come this far, and for example, you're expanding now to host other events?
When we originally built, we were thinking in terms of events and thought this would work, you know, in our current space. But as we've evolved and looked at, well, what is the traffic flow, what makes sense, we're finding we just plain need more space to be able to do some of the things that we'd like to do. And part of it is certainly rentals and to be able to do weddings and more easily do receptions and if somebody wants a business meeting. Also to actually do the classes that I'd like to do, the yoga and wine, the how do you blend your own bottle of wine class, the wine and cheese pairing 101, painting and wine.
All those fun things, yeah. Right? Did you switch from one job to just doing this?
Well, finally, I'm down to one job. Oh. I'm Professor Emerita from Winona State University, and so I retired in May, which now I'm down to the one job here at the winery. And basically, it's similar for Marv. He has been doing engineering consulting and still does some of that, so we can easily fit that in. But now we're pretty much full-time winery.
Would you say that this is becoming a bigger thing for the area? Wineries?
Oh, definitely. You know, you can call it wine tourism if you want, or it's an asset to our communities because we're taking an agricultural product and adding value to it. And in fun settings and with good experiences for consumers. So very much it's good for Winona and Minnesota.
Normally, when people think of Minnesota, they don't think of winery. So has that been something that you've had to do extra marketing for to make people aware?
Well, we do a lot of education and helping people understand, yes, we have varieties of grapes that will grow in Minnesota. And initially, when we first opened, we frequently had people coming in and saying, oh, you can grow grapes in Minnesota. And now, pretty much most people who come to our wineries, and this is true of our colleagues in the business in this area, people are familiar with our, to some extent, our varieties. And so coming to appreciate just that range of flavors that you have in these kinds of grapes. And then the fun experience of coming to a place where you get to taste the wine, you can enjoy the wine, and certainly here you can be doing it close to the vines in beautiful bluffland setting.
Have you noticed an increase in traffic for wine in the area?
Well, definitely our wine trail has helped that because we have 11 wineries that have gone together along the Upper Mississippi River Valley, and this is a way that people can make a weekend or even a 4 or 5 day venture to visit those wineries. And while we all use the same grapes and we're all located in the same part of the world, everybody's grape and winemaking experience is a little bit different. So we're offering the same brand grape name, but the wines are likely to be considerably different. And so that's a way that basically we share among each other, but it's a good way that the consumer can see a wider picture rather than just visit one winery. They get to compare. They may like the wines from one winery and not like them at another. That's certainly part of their adventure. And then while they're doing it, we make sure that we inform them about the Marine Art Museum that we have here in Winona, the Minnesota Equestrian Center down the road from us, and various other activities. So we're trying to encourage these people to spend a day or two right here in Winona and take advantage of some of those opportunities.
What have been some of the big challenges or learning experiences that you two have had during this?
Okay, learning experiences. We're both well-educated. We're a paradox, you know, but have really never been in retail. And so you know the theory of it, you know, because you can easily read and talk to people and certainly have been consumers. But then when you're on the other end of it in terms of how do you carry things, how do you price things, how do you manage that whole end of it, has been a learning curve.
Do you have any insight on what some of the biggest learning experiences for you were?
Well, it was a totally new career for us. And since we started, other things have come along to educate people. There's now a consortium of colleges that have a program called VESTA. And VESTA teaches people how to grow grapes and make wine. and it allows people to get an associate degree in those fields. And so it's a good way for new people to get into the business, where we learn how to grow grapes and make wine by going to short courses and so on and just meeting other people in the industry. It is now possible to get this education. And it's offered for the most part online. And in Minnesota, it's through Central Lakes, a community college up in Staples, Minnesota, coordinates it for Minnesota. But the courses can be taught from a variety of places. So our son-in-law took a course on winemaking last fall, and his instructor was actually from California, and his classmates were from around the country.
You've been winning awards for your wines.
Right.
When did you decide to first stick your foot into the water?
Oh, we must have done that early on, entered some of the winery competitions. Our focus has been to enter ones that focused on our North American hybrid grapes. And it continues to be a problem on some of the competitions that most of your judges understand vinifera, your international grapes, and not as many understand the flavors that you develop in these wines. But definitely we've won at the International Cold Climate Competition, and then the one I really like is out of Iowa, Mid-America, and they give you recipes, and you enter your wine based on that dish. So it's tasted with the food.
Oh, okay.
Because I'm a big believer, if you're eating something, you're drinking some wine. If you're drinking some wine, you're eating something. And that's what's fun. Oh, it just, you know how the flavors complement each other.
Do you guys get nervous before a competition like that?
No, you send it off. Competitions are fairly expensive because you pay an entry fee, plus then you have to send 4, 5, or 6 bottles. So you're giving away product. But then you get the feedback. It's valuable that way.
Tell me some of your favorite wine blends that you make.
Well, blends? We don't make that many blends, okay, because our philosophy has been to emphasize the varietal. So for somebody having our wine could see, oh, if it's Frontenac Gris that was finished as a dry wine, this would be sort of the kinds of tastes you would get. You know, people have an idea of what Chardonnay tastes like, or a Riesling, or a Merlot. Well, not as many people have an idea of what Frontenac Gris, or La Crosse, or La Crescent tastes like. And so it's helping people understand that. But then we do have, some very good blends, that we have a family of blends that are semi-sweet, our Saint-Eudro blends. And then our sweeter ones are the Bluff Country Blushes, and Whites and Reds.
I see a rack of bottles here,
right?
If you had to pick one that you would go to, your favorite go-to, which one would be and why?
Depends on what I'm eating.
Let's say steak.
Oh, a steak? Yeah. Then I do Marquette, which is a dry red, gives you a little bit of pepperiness. Or the St. Croix, which gives you a little pepperiness, a little spiciness, a little blackberry taste to it. Just complements that red beef.
Let's talk about your favorite wine that you make to maybe go with dessert.
Well, we don't usually have wine with dessert, so I don't typically drink a sweet wine. But for steak, definitely the St. Croix is, I think, the nicest one that we have available right now. But for white wine, for fish and so on, the Frontenac Gris and La Crosse are dry white wines, which do very nicely with fish, chicken.
Was this an expensive adventure to get yourselves into?
Oh, yes. You know, you're buying equipment, and we started off with some equipment as hobbyists, and then certainly you have that capital investment of the building and the furnishings in the building. Certainly we're very cognizant of costs and not putting money into something that you don't really need to have expensive chairs. You may notice that you're sitting on the plastic outdoor chairs here, which have worked fine. They don't scratch the floor. They're easy to move. as we continue to upgrade, well, then we'll change chairs and that kind of thing. But you don't start off inexpensively. If you're going to make a good product, you do have to have the proper equipment.
We talked a little bit with expansion, what you want to do, but what's the big picture for the two of you in the end?
Well, the eventual idea is that we want to get out of this business. When you're in your 70s, you need to look at some kind of an exit plan other than waiting for the hearse to arrive. So our exit plan at the current time is that our daughter and son-in-law are becoming more involved with the business, and specifically for the operating of the event room and so on. You know, up to now, we've basically only had the two of us working. And certainly we cannot do events with just two people. And so we need to have ways to bring in additional people to be able to handle, say, a wedding with 100 people and the necessary valet parking and so on. And so it'll be useful to have another generation of the family to become involved.
Well, that's exciting, though. You have something to carry on that you started. What's your favorite part about operating this whole business for you, too?
Oh, what's fun is meeting people. I mean, it's fun taking this product that we grow and turning it into great wine, but it's also fun meeting the whole variety of people that we get to meet, more of the local folks, some of whom we might have known and number who we didn't, as well as the customer base that comes from basically Chicago to the Twin Cities and Sioux Falls over to Milwaukee. But then we get international people and other people from the country who haven't ever seen the middle of the country here and want to see what it's like.
It's really the people. It's just interesting talking. For example, we had some people in today and finding out that he graduated from the same high school I did in Alexandria. And we both have relatives buried in a Apostolic Finnish Church Cemetery in Mo Township of Douglas County. So finding out about things like that with people, you wouldn't think somebody like that would show up in Winona, Minnesota.
I've got to ask, with all the different varieties you've been developing over the years, have you ever had an oops batch? And what do you do with an oops batch?
Yes, we have had an oops batch. And depending upon what the oops was, you open the bottles and dump them out. Or if it's not flawed and it needs to be reworked, then it goes into a vat and then you rework it.
What are some things that can go wrong in the process?
Well, the biggest problem we tend to have is whenever you sweeten a wine. Because whenever you add sugar to it, and that's what people around here tend to like, then there's always the possibility that there's a little bit of yeast left in that wine, and that yeast starts working. And if it does, the worst thing it can do is push the cork out.
Oh, no.
And it's particularly bad if somebody, say, had that wine in a wine rack on a white rug, and that can be quite disastrous. It did not happen to us, but I did have a customer in who bought a bottle of wine at another new winery, and within a week it had exploded. And I found out what it was is they had a screw cap, and with the screw cap it just didn't push out the cork and gradually go out. It physically exploded the bottle. And that would be a dangerous situation. So it's something we really try to avoid. But even with the filtration we do and the sulfur we add to it, occasionally we do have a wine that will ferment again. And there's other flaws. Sometimes when you put a bottle of wine in the refrigerator, it gets something that people call wine crystals. It's really cream of tartar that forms at the bottom of the bottle. And it's something that you try to avoid, but you really don't know if it's going to happen until you refrigerate the bottle for a week or so, and it does show up.
So you're saying it's better to just drink the wine.
Well, and sediment in the wine, as long as it still tastes good, is just fine.
Right.
You know, the wine crystals are not going to affect the flavor. So you just have sediment at the bottom of the bottle.
Is there anything we haven't gone over that you think's interesting to mention?
We'll say that it is very interesting being part of a dynamically growing organization. When we started our winery 8 years ago, I think we were about the 20th winery in the state of Minnesota, and we now have probably somewhere between 50 and 60 wineries. It's hard to get an exact count, but it is interesting to see that much growth within the industry, and it's just different people try different business models. And we talked about dealing with people, our customers that come in, but it's also an interesting just dealing with our other winery partners, both involved with our wine trail, and we also have wine partners with 7 other wineries and have wine at the Minnesota State Fair. So it's just fun to deal with these other people that have come from a variety of backgrounds and seeing how they approach a business problem.
Did you go to the state fair this year?
Several times.
Okay.
Oh, yes. I did one of the presentations at our Minnesota Wine Country there. And so I was talking about wine tourism and how to taste wine and what to expect if you come and visit a winery and how to enjoy the experience.
If somebody were to come in for a wine tasting, do they usually expect one thing and it's something completely different?
Well, we see people who have never been in a winery, as well as people who are very experienced and everything in between. And so if it is somebody who's a real novice, I'll go through the 5 S's of tasting wine with appreciating the look, the sight, and you get to swirl and the smell and the sip and the savor, so that they just get a better understanding of how all to taste wine and what all you can experience when you're having wine. But we try and explain. We welcome people, always try to greet and explain what the tastings are here and their options, which seems to work for most people. You had asked the question about what was interesting in being in the winery business, and another piece of what we do is particularly that hospitality and greeting people, and not necessarily introducing by name to others who are here, but sort of where they're from or maybe a little background, which then enables people to better talk to each other. And so we'll have the deck full some days, and people who don't know each other are from very different places are out there talking and just enjoying meeting other people, which I think is a really valuable thing for people, because there aren't very many settings where you're able to do that.
Do you have any events coming up before the snow flies that you want to make people aware of?
Yes, a big event coming up, and this is part of our Great River Road Wine Trail, will be that first full weekend in November, where we do food and wine pairings at each of the wineries. The individual can purchase a ticket online, and then you come you get a glass and you get your tote bag and you get all kinds of food tastes that are paired with wines and opportunity to meet lots of other people and just have a very good weekend.
Sounds like a great weekend.
Yes, in total, if you visited all 11 wineries, you would have 33 wines and 33 appetizers. And we expect somewhere between 700 and 800 people for that event. So it will fill up some of our hotels here in town, and we do have some people that will try to make all 11 wineries during that period, but visiting a half dozen of them are a pretty good deal, and it gives chance to people to enjoy, because one of the things they do like is they'll be seeing the same people over again. They'll see them at 2-3 different wineries, and then they get a chance to chat what do they like at one place and what they disliked and so on. And just a way for them to meet some new friends from really across all of the upper Midwest for that event.
Great. Well, thank you, too, for taking time. Is there anything else you wanted to add before we close up?
Come on up the hill and visit us.
You bet. Especially come out this spring when we have our new event center open. We will be doing some kind of a grand opening. Did talk to Dr. Barr with the jazz group, and he suggested that would be a good group to have for a grand opening kind of event in the spring.
Thanks again to Marvin and Linda Sebanen for visiting with us on Culture Click. More information on Garvin Heights Vineyards can be found at www.ghvwine.com and on Facebook. More information on the Great River Road Wine Trail, taking place this November, can be found at www.greatriverroadwinetrail.org. I'm Terry Tenseth, and you've been listening to Culture Click.
Creating cultural awareness and understanding. You've been listening to Culture Click. Support for Culture Click is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Culture Click is produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. For more information, look us up on the web at kqal.org. And thanks for listening to Culture Click.